Hello and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb Keith, and the Thinking Fellows is brought to you by the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our shows there. There's a couple interesting things you should look for in the show notes this month. So if you scroll down to the description of this episode, you will see some links. As always, we have a support this show link, but right now we have a bit of a petition down in the show notes to sign up for a new year giving sort of resolution, I guess. But basically what it is if you are enjoying the podcast, if you like to support these shows and what 1517 does, you can sign up for a monthly recurring donation now in the month of January, and that helps us be supported for the entire year. And so you can sign up for whatever amount you want recurring per month, as little as $5 or as much as your heart desires. That goes a long way to help keep these shows ad-free and free. One of the distinctive features of the 1517 Podcast Network is that there are no ads inside of our episodes. These conversations are recorded for you in a non-disruptive way and then edited and sent to you and can be listened to in a way that isn't disruptive, where the whole conversation can be enjoyed. And we also don't put old shows behind a paywall. This is becoming more and more common with podcast networks, even religious ones, to try to keep the content free in order to get the gospel to you as freely as possible. We try not to do that. So we do that by having the support of listeners like you. I think one more thing that you can see down in the show notes is that we have the Bible in 1 year with Chad Bird right now. You can go to the link down below and you can follow along with Chad throughout the rest of this year to read the Bible in 1 year. There's going to be lots of resources there. There's some resources to be read, some videos to be watched, and things like that. So if you're looking for, somebody to help walk you through that, if you've tried reading the Bible, the entire Bible before, and found yourself failing, I think this might be a way to get some help and some encouragement in doing that. All right. So today I am joined by my father, Scott Keith, and today by our guest, Magnus Persson. Magnus, you have come to America. You've been traveling for Christmas. You've spoken at Here We Still Stand. And I know that you write a lot and also speak and teach in Europe. Is that correct?
That's right. Good to be here.
And so we're glad to have you on. And we wanted to do a special topic today, which is, so you're based out of Sweden, right? What part of Sweden?
Mm-hmm. I'm living in Malmö, down in the south of Sweden, and I work from my headquarters up in Uppsala. Uppsala is considered to be the capital city in terms of the church in Sweden, where we have the Dome Church and Church of Sweden have their head office. And I work for a movement inside the Church of Sweden. It's a missions society that has been going on for 170 years.
Okay.
What's it called? EFS, which means Swedish Evangelical Mission.
Okay.
So Magnus published a book with 1517, Caleb, not too long ago, called Reclaiming the Reformation, and has to do with sort of Luther's marks of the church, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah. And so we've touched base. You've also spoken at Here We Still Stand before.
That's right.
And so I'll link your contributor page from 1517 in the show notes too. People can go check that out. They'll be able to see the book there. There'll be a link to purchase the book down in the show notes. Go check it out. And as well, you can see the video from your conference appearance as well there. So that'd be cool. My dad is down in San Clemente with you. So we're recording remotely. And he had, I think, what is a good idea, which is to maybe talk a little bit about Christianity in Europe, or the state of Christianity in Europe. More and more on the Thinking Fellows, we have done topics not under that title, but certainly adjacent to it, something like the state of Christianity in the United States. We recently dealt with some of the survey data about the decline of Christianity in the United States and how over the last 10 years, 14% of Christians, mostly young Christians, have said they don't believe in anything anymore. We've also sort of done some episodes on the opposite about what it's like from the perspective of there are still so many Christians in the United States. So even though we're seeing rapid decline, if you combine Catholics and Protestants, they still make up roughly 60% of the population. And so while Christians here certainly feel like there's a huge amount of decline, they still make up the majority. in the United States. And we thought it'd be interesting to do it from a perspective of somebody in Europe, because we often sort of talk about the differences there. I think we'll throw out phrases. I've heard my dad do this on the show, like, oh, Europe, you know, is, you know, 30 years more secular than us, right?
He had a hard time admitting that I might have had a good idea, first of all. And now he's talking about phrases I throw out willy-nilly.
So, and so maybe we can confirm or deny that from some of your experience there. Anecdotally, one of the things I see is, or hear, is that Europe is secular, that there's faith is dwindled significantly there. But on the flip side of that, I also see that people's speech or familiarity with items of the church seems higher as well. So people will be familiar with church holidays or phrases or offices of the church even. They'll know distinctions in clergy. You'll have, you know, lay people who don't go to church will know what a deacon is or something like this, right? Or know what a bishop is.
That's right.
And in the United States, I would say there's obviously a high amount of Christians and a really low level of like church literacy comparatively. So I'm just curious on how some of this stuff works together. But is that generally true? Is Europe secularized?
Yeah, I think we are ahead of you in terms of statistics and in terms of the way the trend is going. But you have to put all those numbers in context. Like we have been state church. It's a foreign term for you in America, but the state and the church has walked arm in arm since the Reformation. So for 500 years, there've been a government-ruled church, which if you look at the numbers 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, the numbers are horrible. But you have to put that in context. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have had more Christians or better Christians back then. We definitely live in a post-Christian culture, but I wouldn't call it post-religious. People are still aware of, you know, there's a church on every block. We are, I don't know how to phrase it, but highly Christian in terms of what you just said, aware of the Christian tradition and so on. But in terms of active participants in church life, we are very, very low.
It's interesting. When people give up on Christianity in the United States, it seems like they give up on all of it. So not just the belief, but the culture. Mm-hmm. And not only do they give up on the Christian culture, but they seem to like rapidly adopt an antithetical sort of cultural persona. And I think, I mean, it's anecdotal on my side too, but it seems like anytime you go to Europe, that maybe it's just a longer history of Christian influence in Europe. I mean, in the United States, the most we could possibly have is 250 years. Mm. And there are many parts of the early colonies in the United States that were founded with almost no religious influence whatsoever. I mean,
yeah.
New York is a great example of that. Mm. There weren't even, you know, the first 100 buildings they built, there wasn't a church. There were 99 taverns, but no church.
It's a weird mix in the United States, right? Because you had like some states or colonies that were set up as havens for a particular religion, right, with a state church, and then some that were like completely antithetical to it.
And that's a huge difference with Europe. Like in Sweden, we have a 1,000-year of unbroken history of churches.
I mean, in a lot of parts of Europe, you're going to have more than that.
A lot more than that.
Yeah.
And still we have the King of Sweden is by law enforced to be evangelical Lutheran. Otherwise, he cannot be a king.
Right.
We could maybe use a little bit of that. I would.
I don't know. King Charles is forced to technically be an Anglican, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure he is.
Look at the coronation that place.
I've watched The Crown, though. I'm not sure he's really an Anglican.
One of the things that made me realize this is, so the sport I really enjoy, you know, and follow is cycling, which is European in nature, right? There's very little cycling you can digest in the United States, a couple big events here. And I was watching some interview with a team, and the analogy that, you know, the team leader and the domestiques used for the relationship was one of like a church. It was like, oh, I'm I'm like a bishop and they're like vicars. And it was like, it was just church analogies. And I was like, this is extremely foreign because anybody watching in the United States, very few people would have a concept for that. And
well, the terms?
Yeah.
Terms of the bishop terms. Concept, yeah. And because so, I think as a European, when I come to America, I think it's the other way. In America, it's not, you're not afraid of using Christian language like God bless America and all that stuff. That would be very foreign in Sweden, for example.
Even though your king is evangelical Lutheran.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That is interesting. I wonder, and so one of the functions of the state church today, even so there's not people in the United States sometimes hear that and worry about compulsory attendance, stuff like that. That's obviously not the case when you say things like attendance is very low. But one of the distinctions means is that the church gets its funding then through taxes, right? And through the state primarily.
Partly. So there were an official divorce between state and church 24 years ago, but still there are operations like that in place, yes.
And so is there, one of the reasons I think people feel the decline, certainly when my dad and I personally feel the risk of in our area, is that when people stop going to church, those churches disappear. I mean, they close incredibly fast. Like if you get a congregation down to the size of the one we're in, 9 times out of 10, it's going to close within 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, that happened. Like our church, I think I was explaining to you the other day, our church, which is a very, very small LCMS Lutheran church in the mountains, had an influx of people 3 or 4 years ago from an OPC church closing. And that church like sprung up and closed. Mm-hmm. And then our church kind of sprung up a little bit and then it really declined and was on the verge of closing too. And these churches, when they close, they just go away.
Yeah.
They're just gone. There's almost no even cultural trace or history of them ever existing.
Mm. But in Sweden, there's a different reason because there's also a cultural mandate, or how shall I say it, to keep up the church buildings. Like the church building isn't just a storefront. The church buildings have been there for hundreds of years.
They're historical landmark.
So even if you don't care to keep the congregation that congregate in the building up to date, you care very much to keep the buildings and thereof the money and so on. So I think what's happening now in Europe, I wouldn't necessarily, maybe I shock somebody here now in America, but I think it's pretty good what's happening because I believe in a post-Christian society, it's a fertile ground for the pure preaching of the gospel. I'm having a hard time with culturally connected Christians that come to church on Christmas and want to have their marriage performed in church, but then you never see them again. We are still baptizing almost 40 to 50% of the newborn babies in Sweden. So it's still a strong tradition. We still have almost half the population as members enrolled as members in the Church of Sweden. And part of their taxes goes to the funding of the Church of Sweden. I see the opportunity to rekindle that faith and what God has done in baptism. Like the movement I serve, they had a nationwide huge revival, 1850 and many decades after that, where they basically revived what you have in your baptism. They connected with them and saying, you're a Christian, you're baptized. This is how you live daily in your baptism. And there were a revival. And I hope we can see that again.
Yeah, we've been having that discussion a lot, sort of behind the scenes with the Thinking Fellows cast and crew too, just about, you know, that God has never made a promise that your life in the world is going to be easy or will make it easy on you to keep the faith, right? That's not the promise. And in fact, evangelism most often happens when the church is actually under a little bit of attack and is feeling sort of the strain a little bit. When you have an entire, and it's, you know, I'm not going to say one's good or the other is, you know, bad or anything like that, but when you have an entire culture that seems to be sort of aligned a little bit, the call of the gospel can go out and be heard as moralism, be heard as legalism, be heard as pietism, and maybe even be preached that way and not actually be the gospel. But when everything is in decline, or you're feeling the squeeze a little bit, there's a necessity to preach the saving gospel of Jesus Christ to people that are actually truly lost.
Exactly.
And I don't know. It's interesting. I do think, I mean, you said it earlier too, you guys are ahead of us a little bit in this. I mean, we're on, I think, Caleb, the first study we talked about the quote-unquote nuns was 10 years ago, and now this next one came out 10 years later, and things seem worse. But that one 10 years ago was the first time that there was, you know, actually recorded a significant precipitous decline in the number of people that identify as Christians, where I do think Europe's been facing this since the early 20th century.
Yeah, and maybe before that, 20th century, 1900s.
Yeah.
And I think we're almost past the post-Christian culture, and after the post-Christian culture comes the secular culture.
Right.
I think we are more in a post-secular culture.
Yeah, almost.
And we're definitely not post-religious culture. So I see all over Europe that people are, and I think we are by nature, very religious people.
Right.
So I think it's a fertile ground to preach and proclaim a pure gospel.
Well, if in the West, Christianity was the religion of the West, and now it's not, it will be replaced by something.
Yeah.
And because people strive to have connection with each other, with groups of people that are like them, with something that's above them, you know, and something that they can appeal to when they want to say something is right or something is wrong. Mm-hmm. And so we will see that. You're seeing that. I mean, this is the debate over sort of woke, quote unquote, wokeism, right? Is it an ideology? Is it a worldview? Is it a religion? What is it?
I think too, there's some, you know, you don't want to praise the decline or the death of institutions, but in one sense, unless it's government, in one sense, I can see this fertile ground argument even working here in a culture that's sort of maybe less ingrained in day-to-day life, having to interact with the church, right? Like you're not going to walk past a building that evokes that this is a church every day here, especially in California. But the thing I know is that for 20 years, Lutheran churches in particular have been arguing and speculating about what will get people back in them. And you have a very sort of traditional side of this argument, and you have a very sort of progressive side of this argument about what to change in the church to make it appealing to that next generation. But I think the thing those two conversations always have in common is that the old generation wants to stay in power and in control of that institution and what that institution looks like. And they're just trying to turn the knobs to appeal to that next generation. And sometimes when they disappear or they get to the rock bottom, new people actually do come in and sort of shape the traditions, the look, the feel a bit, and have a chance to do what their grandparents or great-grandparents did. And sometimes, you know, we'll have this thing where parts of it have been handed down for thousands of years, say parts of our liturgies and things like that. And so it's not really a generationally changing tradition, but other things are, like what kind of banners are hanging up in your church. You know, I think people who are in the church would not be surprised at how much of a roadblock it might be to say, oh, those are 20 years old, dingy and tacky. Maybe we change how the church is decorated, right? Or overestimate how much changing decoration might bring people in.
Of course. I mean, I know because of the way that our buildings are designed, we rely a lot more on decoration.
That's right.
Than if you're in a beautifully, you know, 1,000-year-old church. You don't really rely on the things hanging on the walls. You
have, in Europe, yeah.
But that's my background, you know. Yeah. So I was originally coming from the relevant church scene. Mm-hmm. I was a Pentecostal pastor, and we planted a new church that was hyper-relevant. But and draw the crowds in, but that didn't help, because what dawned on us, it's the saying of Jesus, and if you twisted a little bit to fit the situation. What does it help a church if it wins? She wins the whole world but loses her yep. soul.
Right.
So I think our chasing of success will be on the sacrifice of the soul of the church, where that's why I wrote the book Reclaiming the Reformation yeah. and the Marks of the Church. So we were going after the people instead of going after the gospel.
Right.
So when we made the change, we saw great fruit out of that. Maybe not in numbers. Maybe there were a decline in numbers, but you have to ask yourself, why are those people here?
Yeah.
So I think that that is a culture that you guys from America have exported to us. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. The whole mega church thinking.
We love giving you our best.
And this of being basically a servant of success rather right. than being a servant of Jesus. So my whole change, ending up being ordained as a Lutheran priest, was, I crashed and burned as a pretty successful Pentecostal pastor, and grace found me. And for the first time, I had the book, The Freedom of the Christians, in my lap of Martin Luther, and I was screaming straight out on the top of my lungs and saying, maybe this is the first time I've heard the gospel.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, that's in ministry for years and years, and it's the first time I heard the gospel. It's
the pure.
Yeah, I understand it, yeah.
Yeah, and I tend to agree. The church that has less to hold on to sort of institutionally has less to lose on that front, has everything to gain by just preaching the gospel.
Mm-hmm. And I think if I look around in Europe among young adults, there is definitely a different trend now. They're not looking for relevance.
Right.
They are looking for well-rooted, stable foundations. Mm-hmm. And they are more drawn, I would say, to liturgy than to contemporary music, contemporary church whatsoever. They are still big, those churches, because it fits the human mind. Mm. Give me a to-do list. How can I have my best life here and now? And, you know, how can I...
The inclination of man's heart is towards the law.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I also find in that the people, especially in younger generations who are looking for churches, are looking for like-minded people in their demographic as well, which is hard to find. And sometimes the church struggles in trying to just attract more and more of those people. And part of it is that there's just not as many of them around. It's not just that the church can't attract them, but that, you know, young people with families who are religious is just you're just getting smaller and smaller demographically across the board. And so, you know, even chasing that is, there's going to be these markers that we try to chase that'll likely get in the way of preaching if that's the only thing we're doing. But there are some churches, even in the U.S., that I would give some high praise to that are sort of realizing this by planting too, like noticing when it's time to sort of, you know, move on and start claiming somewhere else. So I would say the ACNA, the Anglican Church of North America, is investing heavily in that, investing heavily in sort of planting churches and committing to them for a while too, not sort of like say, hey, you have 24 months to prove yourself, but committing to a specific zip code and just dumping resources into doing church as well as they can there.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And we are pretty highly invested in that too, in the Church of Sweden, from our movement to plant new churches, but even more to revitalize old churches, to have a rebirth in the same church, restoring and renew the church. But I think the problem with a deformed church, we can say the church in Europe is generally deformed, but the answer to deformation is not innovation. We want to think that it's reformation, and we have a whole history of that. You know, the people of God, backsliding is not anything new to us. We have a whole book about that. We have a whole history of the people of God backsliding deeply into whatever. But God always raises up a preacher, raises up a prophet, and called them back, not to do something new, but actually to reform and form again what he was creating.
Do you find, so how do you guys, you, it sounds like the group you're part of, so this missionary society, is committed to the idea that in your homeland there can be missions. Now, I think a lot of American Christians sort of struggle with this. I would say American Lutherans in particular, missionary work has been conceived of almost exclusively as foreign missions work. And I've spoken to an increasing number of people who are frustrated with this idea when you have, say, massive areas of decline or backslide in the United States, say, Christianity leaving in droves across the United States, but maybe even specifically like here in the West Coast or on the coasts generally, about, you know, how do you transfer resources or energy into the idea that doing things at churches here, revitalizing churches that are historic or have been in an area or servicing a people now and planting new churches is mission work that, you know, missions funding and evangelism goes to. How has that been for you guys? And how, you said this organization's been for 150 years, so this mindset's existed for a long time in Sweden.
Yeah, and we are heavily involved in world missions too. But when we look at the places where we sent out missionaries 170 years ago, look at Ethiopia. They have the biggest Lutheran church body in the world today. So we need them to send missionaries to us, and they do.
Yeah.
So we would consider Sweden a mission field. But let me take it back. Mission is not first something we do. Mission is a part of our identity, who we are. When you're not missional anymore, you're not biblical. Mission is a part of what the church is. We're always on mission. But we try to see mission not as organized outreach, because I think there is a saying in Sweden, you go over the river to get water. You know, we miss the mark. I don't know if it translates, but
that works.
So it's just stopping at the river.
Yeah. We are sacrificing our own family while trying to reach the world.
Yeah.
We would look way differently if we saw the opportunities for mission right where we at, in our vocations, in our, you know, different position in our community, in our name, together with our neighbors. And usually we say, that's your mission field. You don't have to go to the other side of the city or the other side of the nation or the other side of the world. Go to the other side of the street.
Maybe the other side of the kitchen table. You know?
Yeah, invite your neighbor, not first to church. Invite them for a dinner.
Right.
So we try to equip and train people. I believe what the heart is full of, the mouth will talk, Jesus says. And if we concentrate on giving people the good news of the gospel to the brim so it flows over, well, that's, I love this quote. Can I give you a quote from Luther from his preface to Romans? He asked the question, what is the genuine faith? Well, faith is a work of God in us which changes us and bring us to birth anew from God. It kills the old Adam and makes us completely different people in heart, mind, affections, and all our powers, and brings the Holy Spirit with it. What a living, creative, active, and powerful thing faith is. It is impossible that faith ever stops doing good. Faith doesn't ask where the good works are to be done, but before it is asked, it has done them already. It is always active. Whoever doesn't do such work is without faith and doesn't know what faith or good works is. Even though he shatters on with many great words about faith and good works, faith is a living, unshakable confidence in God's grace. It is so certain that someone would die 1,000 times for it. This kind of trust in and knowledge of God's grace makes a person, here comes a hard word for Lutherans, joyful, confident, and happy with regard to God and all creatures. This is what the Holy Spirit does by faith. And through that faith, a person will do good to everyone without coercion. Willingly and happily, he will serve everyone, suffer everything, for this love and praise of God who has shown him so much grace. Well, we could go on. I think this sums up a part of Luther's teaching, that has very much been an identity for our movement, and absolutely trust in the gospel, and that the gospel bring about that change. And when you look to your right side and your left side, there's your neighbor. And with works that is inspired by the gospel, if you have a single mom with three kids, maybe the first thing she need is not be invited to church, but you invite her for dinner. Maybe you offer yourself as a babysitter and create connections and so on. That's missions for me. And then it will lead to coming to church.
Man, Caleb, this guy's speaking my language. This is vocation. This is local. This is across the dinner table. This is across the street.
This is, yeah, I mean,
about your vocation sort of as that first tight circle, first the people that God has literally put into your life, the people that you see every single day, and then, you know, and that they need the gospel too, and that they need the forgiveness of sins too. And that when Luther says things like, faith doesn't ask what about good works, but because before it asks it, it's already done. That's what he's talking about.
Yeah.
He's not talking about going out and, you know, necessarily talking about going out and serving soup at a soup kitchen for homeless people. He's talking about you fulfilling your vocation in your everyday life. This is why Ephesians 2:10 says, and has prepared in advance the good works that you will walk in that. Them. This is like getting up in the morning, putting on your pants and just walking, and these good works occur in your life, because it's not you that's sitting there saying, I will do this good work, or I will go into the mission field, or I will go evangelize, but it's the Holy Spirit in you through the preached gospel that you have received, now just bringing this out of you in everyday life. This is why we don't ask it, and it's already happened.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. A secular society is not my biggest problem. A secular church is my problem.
Yeah.
And we need to revive that church by the pure proclamation of the good news of the gospel, and reclaim the gospel goodies that belongs to us. And that puts people on fire. And I'm thinking of Isaiah in chapter 6. We built a program for churches on that. And it starts on his lowest point. His king is dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything is going to hell. And said, oh man, I'm smoked. He said, I'm dying, because he has this revelation of God. And there we do a program in four steps, and the first thing is Christ for you. And then it's what Christ has done for you, it's brought to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's Christ in you, and then it's Christ through you. So in the end of those few verses, all of a sudden, the Isaiah who starts the chapter saying, I'm dead, he raises his hand and says, here am I, send me.
That's right.
And that's the, you know, I think we shouldn't have too idealistic view. I think that's one of our problems. I'm very pessimistic. You know, we have way too idealistic view of what a church is. For me, a church is a pearl hidden in the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what Luther speaks about the seen and the unseen church. We cannot really measure how it's going, but there in the dirt, we can only see dirt, but there God has hidden a pearl. And I think what we can revive that, sorry for my Swenglish, I don't find the right words, by the preaching of the gospel. And all of a sudden we see those hands all of a sudden rising up and saying, here am I, send me.
Right.
And I don't think that God primarily sends you to the other side of the world. I think God sends you to the other side of your kitchen table, to the other side of the street. That's where we do missions work. So I want to redefine mission, because to be honest, maybe people are going to be offended. I hate outreach. I've been doing outreach for 25 years. You cannot come up with one creative idea I haven't tried. And the result is hopelessly bad. And I usually do, I travel around all the time speaking in churches, and I do this kind of questionnaire and saying, how many of you are in here today because you met a preacher on the street? Or you, somebody knocked
on the door. Or a handful, yeah.
Yeah, you know, all those outreach. And if I'm lucky, there's two. Then I ask this question, are you here because somebody very close to you, maybe it was your parents or your friend, actually brought you to something, so you could hear the gospel. And all the hands goes up. Mm. So I'm thinking, are we stupid? Yeah. Why are we so invested highly in finance, because it costs a lot of money, in outreach that really doesn't produce any results that is long lasting?
Yeah, you could just see and feel that, some of the first, if a church is doing okay, some of the first auxiliary boards it will build is an outreach committee, right? Some of the biggest ties up your budget will be that. And you're right, it's just these brainstorming meetings about how to send stuff out that once every 5 years, somebody saw the ad in the paper or picked up the pamphlet off their windshield or whatever. And
that's the problem. We have done mission as one of the departments in church, whereas mission is something we first and foremost are. It's a character of the church.
Yeah, I think the other part, and I think this is a big portion of what 1517 tries to do as well, is in order for people to, you said what people have in their heart, they will also speak. But people need to have confidence when speaking about religious matters. These are one of those topics that, right, famously avoided, even when you're with close families and friends. In fact, sometimes we are cautioned that with the people you are closest with is who you should avoid this the most often with, right? Mm-hmm. Is you should not do it. The devil is very crafty in the way he, gets that into everybody's mind, that you shouldn't talk about religion when your family is around.
Mm.
You might offend somebody. And so people need the confidence to feel like they can speak naturally about it, which takes a certain level of familiarity with it, right? You have to actually not just be going to church, but be able to communicate the gospel yourself as well, right? Mm. And so part of it is, as preachers and teachers in the church, is enabling other people to be able to proclaim the gospel in their life as well, to confidently tell people that they are forgiven and free on account of Christ, to be able to speak about things like their baptism. Mm-hmm. And so that they're not just, going to church because they're supposed to, and then they sort of know that you're supposed to go to church. When they tell people to go to church, it's because God wants you to go to church, all this stuff, but that they can articulate without worrying or fretting about it all of these promises that have been given to them. And so we really do have to get that into people's ears. And I think even the frequency of how often you are talking about or hearing or listening or part of conversations that are about the faith, so that you can actually have those without sweating and fretting if you're going to be able to stand down the person across the table with all the right words.
Yeah. And that's why I think you guys do such a great work. We need outlets like 1517. And you can see what it does with people when you listen to your podcast, when you read your material, and you're amazing in publishing this to proclaim and defend the gospel. And it does something with people. And all of a sudden, they have confidence in their own faith. And that will be rings on the water, whatever you say. And think of it. We evangelize people all the time with the latest Netflix series we have seen, or the latest Italian restaurants we have been to, or whatever our heart is full of. When people say, hey, what shall I watch? And all of a sudden we go wild because we have an experience of it. We have, we've done it, and we share with people. And I think it has to start not with the society and changing it into a Christian nation. To be frank, I don't care about that. Let's make the church Christian again. Let's make the gospel great again. And from there on, things will start to happen.
Well, very good. Is there anything, Dad, you want to add?
This latter part of this conversation reminds me a lot of Jim Nestigan's essay, Handing Over the Goods, especially the latter part when he gets into the secondary confirmation. He doesn't call it missions or missional. He just talks about sort of what we feel when we know that people we love are not in the faith. Mm-hmm. And that we have generations where we have that feeling now. I think at the time he wrote that, he said we're two generations in. Mm-hmm. When I've taught it, I said we're maybe on four at this point. His what he says, we can, it's kind of funny. He brings, you brought up baptism, that 50% or so of Swedes are still baptized. He says that that's great. And a lot of pastors hate doing that for people that don't come to church. He goes, that's great. But when you sit and meet with the parents, tell them, okay, this child belongs to us now. And we're going to, we've got a bunch of frustrated grandparents in this congregation who don't see their grandkids enough. And they're going to come give you Friday night off and let you go out on a date. And we're going to read your kid Bible stories. And, you know, it just, it feels like that to me. And I've always loved that part of that lecture so much that, you know, we think of missions and evangelism as out. And Caleb and I have been talking a lot about this lately, which is fine to think of, you know, because obviously, you know, Paul went out into the whole world and he's, but then he set up churches. He set up local communities of people to support one another in the faith. And that is, you know, that is the church.
Yeah.
And
those things have been oddly set at odds, right? That your church and your missions are separate departments, right? And that they need to go do separate things, and church is one thing and mission work is the other. And the church is set up as that voice. They're both the voice of the gospel.
And how can you do in Asia or in Africa what you don't do on your own home turf?
Right.
And we see that pretty clearly where we live, because I always say Monday through Thursday, it's a pretty small town.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see, I mean, it's interesting when we start talking about our church in the public, how many people have had an experience of our particular little church in our little town. And we can see that if you ask somebody to come, it's such a small town and you guys are all so interconnected that if you ask somebody to come and attend, they actually, I mean, I'd say 8 times out of 10,
they'll come for that one Sunday at least.
They do come.
Yeah.
And they do. And I don't know. You can have this, it's funny how small you can, of a scale you can bring to this conversation, and how large of a scale you can bring to it.
Yeah.
You know, you can bring to it the Uppsala scale, you can bring to it the Sweden scale, you can bring to it the Europe scale.
Mm.
And we could do the same thing. You know, we could bring to it like our county, our state, our country, but we can see this in our little town with this little church that is trying to stay alive, preaching the gospel faithfully and administering the sacraments rightly.
Yeah.
And it's...
and I'll say it's sort of inspiring, and I think the right words, in a sense, too, about not worrying that the culture around you is secular. I was talking to somebody else involved in the church down here in Southern California, not our church, but sort of the Lutheran church at large in Southern California. And, you know, he was talking about his frustrations with the amount of people in our synod, in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, who basically, whenever they meet a pastor or somebody who works for the church in California, asks them why they haven't left California yet. Why haven't you left California? And so the idea is,
people say that
the faithful in our church just say, retreat, retreat, retreat. You're surrounded by the enemy.
Yeah.
You should retreat.
Yeah.
Instead of viewing
it as a mission field. Midwest listeners, but I hear it almost every time I have a gig in the Midwest.
Wow. I'm thinking the opposite. I'm thinking the light shines best in darkness.
Yeah.
So I think it's a great opportunity to you know, I think that's our whole story. You know, those who sit in the darkness should see a great light.
Yeah, no, so I really do appreciate that perspective and those right words on the situation is sort of, you know, Christians who are in places like California, you know, the thing is not everybody can retreat. Not everybody can pick up roots and go. And so the gospel still needs to be preached here in California. It still needs to be preached in Sweden. It still needs to be preached in Europe. Anywhere that
you preached in Las Vegas. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. and so the answer is, you know, not encouraging every faithful believer to retreat, but perhaps just encouraging them to preach the pure gospel and to sympathize with the fact that it's probably hard where they're at. In the areas of greatest decline, it's the hardest to feel motivated to do that because you can't see this external success. You can't see a full building. You can't see budgets that are overflowing. You can't see all these things.
And so, really don't see that one.
And so,
yeah. But I think also that stay where you are and understand you want to give your kids the best possible opportunity and environment and so on. But our movement started back in the dark ages of the Church of Sweden, where everybody belonged to the Church of Sweden, but nobody really cared about the gospel. They started against the law. There was a law that you couldn't get together and have prayer and reading and a sermon if you didn't have an ordained priest among you. So they started to get together in house groups, taking care of their family and their kids, reading the apostles of Luther. And that was the starting ground of our movement that swept the whole nation with a huge revival. And God used a young man who was a failed student. He was in the seminary to become a priest. He was the son of a priest. And he had some kind of burnout, and he couldn't even fulfill his priestly studies. God used Carl Olof Rosenius. His books is here in America. You can find them in Minnesota. And he was called the Little Luther. And he was very much inspired by the Moravians, but stayed in Church of Sweden and reformulated and preached what we would call the Evangelic Lutheran message, and rose up an army of confessional Lutherans. It happened, and it can happen again. But It started in the small and in the local. And I love our church order in Sweden saying, the first and primary expression of the church is not a national church body. It's the local church. And I think it happens locally where we are at.
Amen.
Well, very good. This has been a fantastic episode. I'm glad we had you on. It's been a very good conversation. I hope informative and encouraging for our listeners too. I think sort of, especially this, the notes about locally preaching and locally meaning as local as your living room and out into your town and things like that. As one of the primary focuses of the fact that those are the people you have the opportunity to proclaim to is very powerful and strong. So thank you, Magnus, for coming on the show. Thank you, fellas.
It was a great honor.
Yeah, thank you. If you are enjoying this episode, if you enjoy the Think Fellows in general, you can subscribe to this show by hitting the follow button in Apple Podcasts or the subscribe button on many of the other podcasting apps and platforms. You can go and down into the show notes, so you can support this episode of Thinking Fellows. You can support Thinking Fellows in general by hitting the support this show link, and you'll like to go through the links down there. I'm going to put relevant things from this episode down there. We'll put Magnus's book. We'll put a couple other links from the 1517 website and anything else that I think is relevant in there. We thank you for listening to this episode. We will catch you next time. Bye.